Thank you very much, Mr. Shakespeare. Really fascinating speech. Addressed a very basic question of foreign policy. I found especially fascinating these comments on the fractionalization of both long-established and new nations in the world. It certainly presents us with a new range of problems. And I think your talk demonstrated very clearly that there is a new order of both personal and national experience in this era of electronic communications. Now we will hear from two very interesting commentators, two very able minds. Dr. William Schneider, Jr., professional staff associate on the Subcommittee on Defense, Committee on Appropriations of the U.S. House of Representatives. Dr. Schneider is a consultant to the Hudson Institute and a contributor to many military journals and journals dealing with strategic studies. He has a Ph.D. degree in economics from New York University, and he is author. Co-author of the following works, Why the ABM, Policy Issues and the Missile Defense, Food, Foreign Policy and Raw Materials, Arms, Men, and Military Budgets, Issues for the Fiscal Year 1977. Dr. Snyder.
Frank Shakespeare took the liberty of a former government official and decided not to prepare his remarks in advance. As a consequence, some of my discourse may not necessarily respond directly to points he made, but I'm going to try and respond to some of the implications of some points I think he brought up. To begin with, I want to start out with a proposition that I believe that Frank has attributed far too much significance to the power of communications. This assertion may respond to the fact that people tend to like to flex well-developed analytic muscles, and if you are in the communications business, you tend to attribute a lot of influence to communications, whereas if you are selling copper pots, that might seem to be somewhat more important than communications. Nevertheless, let me just make a couple of comments about communications first before getting into some other points. To begin with, I think communications does have an important mischief value. That is, regardless of what the reality is, communications can create a certain amount of confusion. I can just cite two that have emerged within the past hour or so. There is a scurrilous fellow associated with Harvard named who shares both my Christian name and surname, and has been widely quoted, and I've had an enormously difficult time trying to persuade people that I am not, in fact, responsible for those statements made. Yet, even in these remarks, I find this scurrilous character quoted. One example of the mischief power of communication. Another example, and I think one of the let's say, data points that suggest that we may have some problems is in the collection of books that we have out in the tables in the anteroom adjacent to this room. There is a particularly vile piece of American anti-American propaganda by a fellow who is not a pacifist, who recommends essentially the disestablishment of the U.S. defense policy, and yet this kind of thing parades as I think some sort of libertarian tract, but as a practical matter, it suggests that we have real communications problems just among ourselves. And this reflects not so much the power of the electronic media or the print media or anything else, but merely an inability to make each other understood. I think we should attribute some important values to communication, and I certainly wouldn't dismiss them. We had a very moving statement last night about the importance of culture and the real need to try and find better ways to communicate the essential values of our culture. And I think in the long run, communications is extremely important to that because our culture does in fact exist. It has a very long history and has very many important elements that can only be transmitted through some kind of communications media. And I certainly would support some kind of Kulturkampf, which certainly seems to be necessary if any of the evidence that we've seen in the past few years means anything. But saying all that, I still think Frank's statements tend to overstate the significance of communication. What we, I think, have to focus on is what, for want of a better word, we call real things, not things that are have reality only because they get communicated or get distorted in the communications process. And again, at the risk of flexing well-developed muscles, let me work on my particular hobby horse, which happens to be military power. It happens not to be entirely unrelated to Frank's statement, because he was speaking a good deal about the international dimension of our public policy concerns. And Frank went to some lengths to discuss the situation in Europe and attributed a good deal of the malaise or worse that we see in Europe to the problems of communication. Well, I'd like to suggest that the real problems in Europe are fundamental and are not associated with communication, and are not necessarily made either better or worse by the existence of more efficient means of communication. I'd like to cite as a principal example the issue of military power in Europe, particularly the imbalance in the same. The real reason why West European powers are appear to be extraordinarily weak is because they have a perception that, as compared to Soviet power and the potential, if that power were exercised, would leave them with absolutely no ability to run their own affairs. This a sort of an axiom that I've repeated in a number of forums, but I'll use it here because I think it's pertinent, is that international relations is the only field of human endeavor where agreements made under duress are considered valid and binding. And it's in some ways a sort of trivial observation, but nevertheless it seems to be one of the more transcendent points made this afternoon. I just like to acquaint some of you. Many of you are already acquainted with some of the details, but I always find the statistics important reading, because they tend to make it more easy to understand why Europe is so weak, why West Europeans appear to be so incapable of responding effectively, and you have all of the centrifugal forces that Frank mentioned, especially in Western Europe. The Soviet Union now deploys about 36,000 tanks west of the Ural Mountains. Taken with armored personnel carriers and artillery, these are the three principal means of conducting offensive warfare. The United States has about 8,000 tanks in its inventory, including those at the Aberdeen Museum. The Soviet Union deploys 55,000 armored personnel carriers. The United States has 21,000, about half of which have gasoline propulsion, which General Patton denounced in 1942. We still have them. The Soviet Union has about 21,000 artillery pieces in its inventory. The United States has about 2,000. Just to give you a piece of data that suggests the significance of this disparity. In examining the way the Soviets would conduct a war in Europe, it's a sort of an updated version of the World War II Blitzkrieg that the Germans made famous. And this would involve thrusts in about six areas in, across the West German border. The Soviet tactic is to blast a hole through Western defenses about 4 kilometers wide by, 8 kilometers wide by 4 kilometers deep. The salvo weight, as it's called, the amount of tons of explosives that the Soviets can put on a target is about 18,000 tons in this 4 by 8 kilometer area. That's about 65 rounds per acre. And I assure you that would make it a very undesirable place to live in a very short period of time. These kind of statistics, I submit, are not lost on people, and the whether or not the United States is effective in communicating its good intentions to East European dissidents, whether or not the United States is effective in communicating the need for Western resolve and Western solidarity, these are all undermined by the fundamentals or real things that I think transcend whether or not information can be effectively communicated. The real disparities in capabilities are the things that I think are more fundamental to especially international relations than mere perceptions that, however they may be communicated with or without distortion. I think, is something that is inadequately communicated. And let me mention just another example. If you look at the consequences of post-Vietnam politics, or when at least when it became clear in the Pacific Basin that the United States was going to withdraw from the Pacific, you had a reversal in where the governments in Australia, New Zealand, Japan, all went left. That is, the existing relatively conservative regimes were replaced with somewhat more liberally or socialist-oriented regimes that initially sought an accommodation with the communist forces in East Asia. It's only in the past year or so that we've seen a reversal of this, as the self-confidence of the say conservative states of the Pacific Basin, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and to some extent Korea, have decided that they are going to try and take care of their own defense rather than rely on the United States. This, again, I argue, is something that is not predominated by what information is communicated, but by a genuine understanding of what the real balance of forces are. So another point relating to this is the overstatement of the importance of nationalism. Nationalism is no doubt a very powerful force, but it is not effective, as Mr. Sable noted last night, when you have a very well-organized totalitarian state that is efficient right down to the level of the family in suppressing dissent. And it is, again, these real things that predominate over what is communicated. I'll stop here and go on for questions.